Judgment of the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the United States Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals, draw near. The court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. The court is called to order. The court calls the case of United States versus Staff Sergeant Adolphus A. Young III, ACM 38761. The appellant presents one issue for our consideration during argument today. It is whether the convictions of Specifications 3 and 4 of Charge 2 are factually insufficient because appellant's conduct does not constitute a battery under United States versus Gutierrez. Are both sides ready to present argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant's counsel, you may proceed. And
thank
have you.
You
reserved any time?
Yes, Your Honor, 4 minutes.
4 minutes, thank you.
Good morning, Senior Judge Mitchell, Judge Dabrisky, Judge Brown. May it please the court. I, Captain Michael Schramma, along with Major Isaac Kennan, represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Adolphus Young. Appellant stands convicted despite the fact that his conduct is insufficient to sustain a conviction. Under United States v. Gutierrez and its adoption of Her Queen Majesty v. Courier, there are no facts to suggest appellant's conduct created a reasonable risk of transmission of HIV. As a result, his plea to Specifications 3 and 4 of Charge 2 are improvident. CAF stated in Gutierrez that without disclosure of HIV status, there can be no true consent. Now,
counsel, you would concede that your client, during the providency plea, admitted that he did not reveal his HIV positive status.
Yes, Your Honor. But as we look at that statement in its context, we have to take into consideration two important circumstances. The first is, CAF did not create a strict liability offense, meaning that just because you have HIV and do not disclose that fact does not make you per se guilty of assault consummated by a battery. There is no history in our case law to suggest that is a per se violation, and there's no congressional intent or enactment to create law that makes it a per se offense. The second thing to take into consideration, that statement by CAF in and of itself is not a true statement. If you look at Courier and what Courier actually says, it states, an accused failure to disclose that he is HIV positive is a type of fraud which, keyword, may vitiate consent to sexual intercourse.
Counsel, when you say it is not a true statement, are you saying that CAF had an error in their opinion? Are you saying that they extended what their authority was in stating that? What do you mean by it was wrong in CAF when CAF said that?
And Your Honor, I don't necessarily imply that them citing the case or using the case is wrong. What I'm stating for is the fact that there seems to be, at least from the government's perspective in their brief, some question as to on its meaning, that first statement that CAF uses, that it vitiates consent.
Okay.
And that statement in and of itself is not true. Now, could it vitiate consent? Yes. What we're not challenging today is the ruling in Gutierrez itself. There are going to be some cases out there where the specific facts meet the test set forth under Courier and will be tantamount to aggravated assault.
But Courier is not the law of this court or CAF. I mean, they didn't adopt it. If they were going to adopt the principles in Courier, would you agree that they would have been a little bit more intentional than just to cite the signal C when really they're talking about consent, which is an element of the offense in this case? Would you agree, disagree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a good point that you make, but I think the inverse of that is also true, that how, if CAF was going to create law, wouldn't they go into more detail to establish the law? Especially in consideration, as I said, there's no precedent to make assault consummated by a battery
Well, but they cited that for a principle of consent, which consent is a element when we're looking at assault consummated by battery. And so, I mean, they could have cited Black's Law Dictionary. They could have cited Article 120. There could have been a lot of other areas that they could have cited. But, I mean, the issue is whether or not there was consent or not on an assault consummated by the battery. That's, again, what the court appears to be looking at. So I don't know how we're going off into what the Canadian case stood for when there's at least no appearance that, in fact, that's what CAF meant. And I think in the government's brief they referenced the fact that Gutierrez wouldn't have been able to be convicted if, in fact, you apply the standard that you're now asking this court to apply.
Yes, Your Honor. But it goes back to the fact that if we look at Currier, the little snippet that CAF includes in the Gutierrez brief is not an accurate depiction of the law that was announced by the Canadian court.
Why does it matter what the law is announced by the Canadian court? I think that's what Judge Dabrowski's question is. We follow the law. We're not a Canadian court. We are a military court, and we follow the laws established by Congress, which has simple elements for assault consummated by a battery, and then the interpretations of that law as set forth by our precedent and by CAF's precedent. So why does it matter if Canada later changes a law or changes the case law that has a signal distinction that CAF has cited as almost an aside?
But then, Your Honor, we have to ask ourselves the question, why would CAF then cite to an inaccurate statement of the law to get where they want to go? If that was the case, they could just state this is a simple premise without citing to any law. And that's the question. The fact that they cite to the Canadian case.
Are you saying that Gutierrez, when they concluded that, or when they found the lesser-included offense of assault consummated by a battery in that case, when they reached that conclusion, that CAF was incorrect, that was an incorrect decision?
No, Your Honor.
All right. So can you distinguish Gutierrez from this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I think the first thing we have to do is we look at Currier and we look at the law that they have announced in that case. One of the trailers that came out from Currier in the Canadian courts was Mabier. And Mabier announced essentially a two-pronged test. They announced the fact that there should be no conviction where A, the individual had a low viral load, and B, they engaged in protected sex. Now, interestingly enough, when CAF applied the facts of Gutierrez to that case, although most of the specs would not have fallen into that test, there was in Gutierrez a specification of vaginal unprotected sex, which CAF did affirm. Why CAF did that, we don't know. They didn't go into an analysis of the facts in that case to decide why that was an assault consummated by a battery. In our specific case, we have anal sex that was protected. We have on the record that the appellant did not ejaculate during anal sex. We have the fact that he, as I said, was protected, and he had, by all accounts, a moderate to low viral load at the time of the sexual intercourse. So how are those facts distinguished from Gutierrez? On their face, they seem very similar. I do think one of the important facts to consider is that with the protected sex, we do have evidence in the record that the appellant did not ejaculate, which is something that on its face, in the opinion of Gutierrez, is missing. Gutierrez, as I said, in protected sex. I think I said unprotected. There was a specification of protected sex. But again, CAF does not go into why that specification was upheld or not. But that goes to the point that we talked about in the beginning. Each case is going to be specific to the facts of that case. So for whatever CAF is looking at, for some reason, they saw fit that it met the test under Currier and Mabier to uphold.
All right, when you say for some reason, that's kind of what I'm driving at, is do you have a reason? Do you have a theory so that if this court elected to find that the plea is improvident, that it would still be consistent with Gutierrez? Or are you in a position of, we have no idea as to what CAF was thinking, so therefore ignore it and come up with a new body of law?
Your Honor, I think the best answer to that question is just the looking at the facts of our case and the low viral load, the protected sex.
Isn't that the same as Gutierrez, though, where it's a low viral load and protected vaginal sex versus Gutierrez?
It is, Your Honor.
And they affirmed the conviction to the LIO in Gutierrez.
That is absolutely correct, Your
Honor. Why is protected anal sex for your client different?
Your Honor, CAF did not give us enough of analysis for us to be able to have this discussion that we're having right now. The best answer I can give you is looking at the facts of our case and applying it to the cases that CAF cited in coming up with their test. I think Young, the appellant's case, falls squarely on the side of, especially with the protected anal sex, as not passing the test is what consummates an assault consummated by a battery.
This is a guilty plea, so why are those factors relevant? Nowhere within his care inquiry did he mention his viral load, because it's irrelevant, really, to whether or not he had sex with individuals without disclosing his HIV, therefore, whether we get into the fraud or whatever the consent issue is. So why, in fact, are those factors even relevant to what we should be looking at here, is whether or not the plea is provident, as you said in your opening?
Your Honor, at the time of the trial, Gutierrez did not exist. So whatever the trial judge was relying upon at that time may or may not have been good law. And the appellant, at least up to the judge and the law that he was applying, it may have been an acceptable plea.
But any of those facts is not relevant to what the elements were that your client pled guilty to.
I disagree, Your Honor.
Okay, and how is his viral load relevant to whether or not he engaged in a unlawful touching without the consent of the parties?
Because if you look at Courier, Your Honor, which is in Gutierrez, which comes subsequent to appellant's case, they have said that the disclosure of infection is only required if there is a realistic possibility of actual transmission of HIV.
Right, and I get that, and that's Courier. Our Superior Court has basically said consent means meaningful, informed consent. So I think what Judge Brown had asked earlier, are you trying to say we should ignore that? Because if not, that is the law that is before this court that we're required to follow unless there's somehow we can distinguish that. And so that's where I'm trying to figure out where those facts are relevant into the issue that should be the discussion, which is why was this plea not provident?
Well, Your Honor, I think your question goes directly to a discussion of fraud in the factum versus fraud in the inducement. And what we have here, so the sex is not the battery when you have HIV and engage in sex. The battery is the HIV. So when we're looking at fraud in the inducement and fraud in the factum, this is not fraud in the factum. With fraud in the factum, U.S. v. Carr has said fraud in the factum is when you are pretending to be a third person or that you are a doctor using the premise of medical exams to gain access to sex.
And those are some cases, but it's also the fact that you are misrepresenting the agreement. And was the agreement not here the fact that they were having sex? I mean, that's what they went there for. So if there was something related to the sexual act that was being misrepresented, would that not be fraud in the factum? I mean, the cases that you just cited there, it talks about whether the individual's holding themselves out as the doctor, whether it's a woman that believes she's having sex with her husband, but it's somebody else. It's that type of misrepresentation. How is this different in the fact that he's misrepresenting his status as HIV negative versus HIV positive?
Because, Your Honor, the appellant's sexual partners understood the nature of the sexual act, and they knew the identity of the appellant. And that is the test set up by the fraud in the factum. This is much more like fraud in the inducement. I mean, fraud in the inducement, you could tell somebody, hey, I'm not married, let's have sex, and it turns out you are married. It doesn't vitiate the consent. It's fraud in the inducement.
So does it change if he would have intentionally said, and we can get to the South Carolina incidents where he had it posted on his meeting page, but does it change then if he would have gone to those individuals and said, I'm HIV negative.
No. It's still fraud and inducement, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't Gutierrez, though, say, indicate that that's not how we should view this? I mean, they do say that without disclosure of the status, there's no meaningful consent. So isn't that fraud in factum versus fraud in inducement?
No, Your Honor. I mean, and I think in order to put that into context, we have to cite Currier, which is the premise for this. And the key word in Currier is may.
Going back to Canadian cases, aren't both those Canadian cases, aren't those HIV aggravated assault cases? And here we're talking about assault consummated by a battery where the only question is bodily harm. So I guess my question is, when you keep on going back to the Canadian cases, how relevant is their analysis when they're talking about aggravated assault when we're talking about a mere assault consummated by a battery?
I mean, Your Honor, CAF saw fit to adopt that rationale from an ag assault case to a simple battery. CAF could have found a case dealing with a simple battery that vitiated consent. They didn't, so we're stuck with analyzing the Canadian law. I mean, this would be different if I found some random case and tried to bring it in here to challenge Gutierrez. The fact is, CAF likes this case. CAF used this case to justify this rationale. So we may not like applying Canadian law, but that is the hand that CAF has forced.
Or the alternative is they like the statement that they put in the opinion, in CAF's opinion, from the Canadian opinion. There's a lot of stuff going on in the Canadian opinion. It's 10, 15, 20, 30 pages, whatever it is. But out of all of that, they picked out one particular sentence. So isn't another possibility is that CAF liked that one sentence?
It is, Your Honor. But it goes back to the point that it's not a correct statement of the law. So I think it's hard for us to understand why CAF would cite to a premise that is legally not true in Canada. The better practice, if that was the case, that CAF did not want to adopt this reasoning, is just to say, you know what, when you have HIV and you don't tell someone, it vitiates consent. There can be no consent without disclosure.
Which is what they said, though.
But
they cite a signal C to a case that has discussion of that proposition doesn't mean that they have somehow adopted it. And from what I understand, I mean, that's really what you're asking us to interpret, CAF, that they have adopted this two-part test that's in this Canadian case. Again, if they would have done that or if they wanted to do that, they have clearly in other cases been very clear when they're going to adopt a principle from a federal district court. I mean, if they mean it, they're going to say it. They're not going to cite to a signal C. And so that's where I'm trying to figure out what is the authority for the belief that somehow that site incorporates now, pulls in this Canadian case law within there, versus their discussion of consent, which is an element, which is critical in this case because it is a providency of a plea issue.
Your Honor, because there's nothing else that allows CAF to do this. There is no congressional intent that has enacted this law, and there is no other stateside case history that they're relying upon. It would have been much better if CAF said, yes, we're going to apply this congressional law, or we're going to reach back and apply this case law from 5 years ago as our premise. It doesn't exist, so we have to assume that they are reaching somewhere to create this new law, and they reached to Canada.
Does CAF have the ability to create new elements for the MCM?
They can interpret the law.
Or they can find that it fails to state an offense, but they don't. I mean, the manual is what the manual is until Congress changes it. And at this point, we have an assault consummated by battery, which has its requisite elements. So I guess that's another thing when we're talking about if they really wanted to adopt something, they could use the words to really show it and demean it. But they don't have that authority. So why are we reading the fact that they can basically create a new element or an interpretation of an element in a manual where they don't have that authority?
But, Your Honor, they're not creating new elements. They are simply... they're using that test to decide what vitiates consent, which is an element. So they're not creating this new consent element. They're just citing to a Canadian case that develops the case law as to what consent is. So there are no elements.
And in the opinion, they said meaningful informed consent, as Judge Mitchell stated. So that, to me, would seem to be the law that is out there, not what is supporting the law or supporting the statement of the law. But again, the defense's position, the appellant's position, is that somehow we shouldn't look at what they said, we should look at what they cited.
And, Your Honor, it's a valid point that you make, and essentially what you're posing is the crux of the case, how you interpret how CAF cited this Canadian case. And yours is the counterpoint. We believe that, as I said, if that was going to be their rationale, they would have cited to something stronger than, you know, the Canadian case. And by adopting the Canadian case, they are inevitably adopting the analysis that goes along with that.
Okay, so assuming that the law is what CAF said, it was meaningful informed consent, let's throw the Canadian case out. Where in the providency of this specific plea, then, do we have an issue?
But then, Your Honor, it's a strict liability case. So under that analysis, anytime you have HIV and you engage in sex without giving notice, you're automatically guilty.
Okay, so there's nothing else within the providency plea that you see that would cause us to question the judge's acceptance of the plea other than that one specific issue?
No, Your Honor, because if you accept the strict liability premise, there's nothing that the appellant can say. I mean, there would be nothing in the record.
Well, counsel, I want to interrupt you here with the strict liability, and earlier you said the per se violation. It's a violation because it meets the elements. I mean, if I go and punch somebody in the face, it's a violation of the law unless I have consent. If I'm in a boxing ring, if we've agreed to a brawl. So isn't that the same thing here? It's not a per se violation. You have to have committed the did bodily harm, and bodily harm with was done with unlawful force or violence, indicating that there was no consent. So much like me in the boxing ring, if I'm punching somebody in the face in the boxing ring and I have consent, not an offense. If I go down this out of this building and punch somebody in the face, I've committed an offense. So I don't see your argument that it's a per se or strict liability offense. There's still an act that needs to be committed by, in this case, your client.
But, Your Honor, the assault, the battery is not the sex. The battery is the risk of the HIV. And if we look back, prior to today's argument, I submitted a supplemental citation, U.S. v. Johnson. And it's an older case dealing with ag assault, but they took into question what is the assault. And in that specific case, Johnson said that the semen is the battery, not the assault. Semen carried the HIV infection and was the vehicle or means to cause harm. CAF,
didn't Gutierrez reject that? And when Gutierrez came back in and they took a look at this, they said, HIV is one thing, but we need to look at how likely HIV is. So doesn't Gutierrez reject what you've just said, that the battery is HIV? It seems to me that what Gutierrez was doing was they said, no, we need to determine the likelihood of contracting HIV, not that the what constitutes the battery would be the actual HIV itself.
I think what Gutierrez rejected was the likelihood of harm. I think the semen, the HIV, is still the vehicle of the harm, but Gutierrez rejected this likelihood of harm and the enhanced punishment that comes along with aggravated assault versus simple assault and how the law differs to see the harm and caused by each action. Obviously, you know, there's a difference between a simple assault punch and, you know, a grievous assault with a wrench. So I think Johnson is still good for the premise of what is the assault. I do not believe it's good in developing the likelihood of contracting a disease which would cause death. So I think the second part drops off, as you point out, sir, but it's still good for the what is the assault? The assault is not the sex. The assault is the HIV.
It's good for an aggravated assault. I mean, that's the entire case. And then again, that case went to stand for the proposition you can't consent to an aggravated assault. So, I mean, that's really what it seems to stand for at that point. Again, getting back to the elements of what your client pled to was not aggravated assault. So are you now arguing that, in fact, it should have been instructed that the sexual contact was not the unlawful act, and that it was the actual transmission of bodily fluids that was the act?
Your Honor, I'm not arguing that he was misinstructed to the actual elements of the assaults consummated by a battery.
Then why is the other discussion relevant? If he was properly instructed and he admitted to the elements for the offense, then the rest of this, why is it relevant to our discussion?
Going back to Senior Judge Mitchell's question, what is the assault? The assault, the appellant believes, is not the sex itself, but the possible transmission of the harm.
And again, that's my point. At trial, though, it was the sexual act. So are you now saying that the military judge erred in the fact that he did not recognize that the sexual act was not the assault, instead it was the transmission of seminal fluids that should have been the bodily harm?
In a way, yes, Your Honor. I mean, the plea is improvident in light of Gutierrez. I mean, with the law that the trial judge had at the time, he's fine. But now when we look in light of Gutierrez, we're looking at consent. And our case law as to what includes the assault, but also looking at what the Canadian law considers to be the risk of harm, both of those things are looking at the possibility of harm, the HIV, not the simple act of sex. So in that case, yes, I mean, the military judge, in light of Gutierrez, should have looked at that test to determine the likelihood of harm.
Counsel, one of my jobs as senior judge is to keep you on time, which I think I've allowed you extra time, but we'll still give you your 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Government counsel?
Senior Judge Mitchell, Judge Dubrisky, Judge Brown, may it please the court. I am Captain Tyler Musselman, and with me is Colonel Catherine Oler. Together, we represent the United States in this case. Relying on United States versus Gutierrez, this court should uphold appellant's convictions for assault consummated by a battery as appellant pled guilty pursuant to a pretrial agreement of engaging in sexual acts with a number of individuals without disclosing his HIV status. First, factual sufficiency is not applicable to this case. RCM 910J states that a plea of guilty which results in a finding waives any objection, whether
Counsel,
or not...
you can move on to... I think we're all at the providency stage at this point. Thank you.
Now, the standard of review for providency is abuse of discretion. A court may overturn a guilty plea only if something in the record with regard to the factual basis or the law raises a substantial question regarding appellant's guilty plea. United States v. Faircroft recognized that courts are not to overturn a military judge's acceptance of a guilty plea based on a mere possibility of a defense, and they will not speculate post-trial as to the existence of facts which may invalidate a guilty plea. Instead, there need only be factual circumstances on the record which objectively support the plea. So this is the structure in which to view appellant's guilty pleas in this case. In this case, appellant's admissions objectively support his pleas to specifications 3 and 4, charge 2, assault consummated by a battery. He was advised what the elements were, did bodily harm was done with unlawful force or violence, he was given the definitions by the military judge, and the factual circumstances as laid out through his care inquiry as well as the stipulation of fact the appellant signed objectively support those pleas. He stated the dates, the locations, the acts, unprotected oral sexual intercourse with various individuals, specifying each time that he did not inform them of his HIV status, protected anal intercourse with various men without informing them of his HIV status. He also identified the risk of transmission through those acts in his care inquiry. While I understand the oral sex and not ejaculating in the mouth does greatly reduce the risk of HIV transmission, it does not remove the risk entirely. Regarding specifications 4, he said, while I understand condom use reduced the risk, it did not eliminate the risk entirely.
Counsel, I want to ask you about the bathhouse anonymous sex that the appellant talks about. And there, and I'm going to quote from the care inquiry, he says, it was impossible to identify any of the other people in the room. and there was very little talking, if any, done. All of the people that entered the room did so for the purpose of having anonymous sex. I did not inform these men that I was HIV positive, and I did not wear a condom for oral sex. Did those individuals then consent to this sexual activity if they're entering the room for the purpose of having anonymous sex and with very little talking? Is the burden on the appellant to disclose his HIV status, or can someone consent saying, I don't want to know, I don't want to hear from you, I'm just in the bathhouse here to have quiet, anonymous sex?
Well, Your Honor, that's answered in Gutierrez. And as pointed out, in Gutierrez, they cited Currier for the sentence. They quoted it for this language specifically: without disclosure of HIV status, there cannot be a true consent. So unless he disclosed HIV status, the individuals did not consent to having sexual intercourse without.
Could there be circumstances, surrounding circumstances, that would suggest implied consent? I mean, for example, if an individual is going to a bathhouse in Las Vegas for anonymous sex, and in some situations those individuals elect to use condoms, sometimes they don't, isn't it foreseeable that the individuals they're engaging with may very well have HIV, may very well have other STDs, and that the individual is agreeing and consenting to sexual contact with people that may have that disease?
Well, Your Honor, I would say in this case it's a guilty plea. And so, as I previously stated, whether there's potential facts and circumstances that could lend to being acquitted of this offense is something that the appellant should have litigated that at trial.
So what did the accused say regarding consent as to that Las Vegas incident, you recall?
Well, Your Honor, if you look, he goes through a number of incidents. He goes through all of the incidents regarding the bathhouse at Hawks Gym in Las Vegas. I did not inform these men that I was HIV positive, and I did not wear a condom for oral sex. I never ejaculated during oral sex, but ejaculated in a towel. Then he goes through the other circumstances as well. And in closing, he says, my partners had a right to know about my HIV status. Do you believe you cause an offensive touching to your sex partners when you engage in unprotected oral sex without them knowing you're HIV positive? Yes, sir.
And that's all right. So that's the bodily harm. That's the first element. So he did say at a later point, did he not, that that while they consented to the sexual activity, in so many words, that he believed they would not have consented if they would have known of his HIV condition.
Yes, Your Honor.
What about, there just seemed to be a very broad discussion about consent by the judge here. I mean, he really didn't drill down to any of the issues. I think one of the comments was they would not have consented if they had known my status. He made another comment on the record that they would not have consented if they were HIV negative at the time. Did that not require the judge to drill down a little bit more and to actually see whether or not, what the basis was for that consent, versus just accepting the accused, you know, blanket statement that these individuals did not consent?
Well, I'm going to address that in a couple of ways, Your Honor. First is, throughout the entire care inquiry, the judge repeatedly addressed the issue of consent and lack of consent, and that everyone in that courtroom that day were completely understood the theory that was put forth, as in, if the appellant did not disclose his HIV status, there was no consent. For example, I believe it was battery because these men did not agree to have sexual relations with me without first being informed of my HIV positive status. My partners had a right to know about my HIV status. Do you agree to having unprotected oral sex without the consent of your partners and that they would not have had sex with you had they known? Do you agree that was a battery and it was an unlawful application of force? Since they would have not consented if they knew my status, I now understand that constitutes force. I believe it was a battery because this man did not agree to have anal sex with me without knowing my HIV positive status. So consent is thoroughly fleshed out throughout the entire care inquiry. In regards to whether any defense existed because the partner may have been HIV positive, that goes back to the court I stated earlier about the standard of review. If there's a potential factual defense that appellant could have put on, he waived that right at trial, as in if and whether or not a partner is HIV positive means that you cannot commit assault consummated by a battery without informing them of your HIV positive status, that would be a question left for a different case.
Do you believe that CAF created an affirmative duty to disclose HIV in Gutierrez before engaging in sexual activity with someone, if you wanted to escape criminal culpability for that action?
Yes.
All right. What do you believe what have they actually created? In other words, did they create another HIV exception to assault consummated by a battery? When we're talking about HIV, you've got to let them know. For everything else, apply the normal assault and assault consummated by a battery rules and elements.
No, sir, I don't think it's carved out. I think what they found is, and in the fraud and the factum cases, the court brought to the party's attention, Carr and Booker, I believe. What you see there is, in those cases, there's even an identification of kind of a categorical identification of circumstances that would constitute fraud in the factum. And so...
And let me cut you off a little bit before you get too far down the fraud. All of those fraud cases are situations where consent was achieved, but the accused in that particular case, or the accused in those particular cases, misrepresented who they were, allowed a misrepresentation to continue, lied about something. Do we have, in this case, any affirmative statements by the appellant that he was HIV negative, such that he could commit fraud to vitiate the consent?
Well, I think what you have is there's two different things you can look at the Gutierrez opinion, sir. Is one, the primary is Gutierrez established that without disclosure there is no consent. And so what they've done is they've identified a categorical circumstance, much like someone acting like another spouse, that there's no consent to begin with. The other vein you can look at it is through a window of fraud and factum. And so the primary argument is that under Gutierrez, there's no consent to begin with. It's without disclosure. And by doing so, they've identified these circumstances. That's the government's primary argument and what Gutierrez stands for.
Let's expand it a little bit more, see if you could perhaps help me a little bit with this decision, since CAF did not provide a lot of explanation as to the reach and the analysis that they were engaging in. Would this apply equally to non-disclosure of herpes?
Yes.
All right. Does it make a difference whether or not the herpes is active at that particular time or is not active, such that it's unlikely that it would have been passed on to his partner or to her partner?
Well, sir, in that circumstance, if there's no, even though the risk was minimal or almost zero, as quoted in the Gutierrez, there is some risk of HIV transmission. I think that's what's, that's why there's no consent.
So you think it's an STD affirmative disclosure rule?
Yes.
That they're talking about. All right, suppose an individual has leprosy and they come up to you and they don't let you know they have leprosy and they hold out their hand to shake your hand and you agree to shake their hand. Is that an assault consummated by a battery? Does the individual have leprosy have an affirmative duty to disclose their communicable disease?
Yes. Yeah, so consider if it's transmutable in that fashion, that'd be considered an offensive touching.
So you would read Gutierrez to apply to any disease an individual has an affirmative duty to notify the other individual that they've got it. Otherwise, there can be no consent.
Well, I think that the disease has to go to the nature of the act, right? HIV is coming up in this case because there's sexual acts, and that's how the disease is transmittable.
And, what you're suggesting, it seems to be a major change in the law, creating all affirmative duty in a lot of different areas. Don't you think it's odd that CAF would do that without any sort of explanation or perhaps stating some of the things that I've asked you about?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it's not broad. I think that it's really, they've just identified it and it becomes applicable in the realm of communicable diseases. I don't, for example, if someone has cancer that can't be transmitted, engages in sexual intercourse, given there is absolutely no risk of transmission through the intercourse, it would not come into play. That, as I said, is the government's primary argument of what Gutierrez stands for. If you switch that into the realm of fraud and the factum, there's some leeway there in regards to, you can kind of see how it, and that's how it applies kind of to the nature of the act. One thing, Carr and Booker, those are extensions of what the traditional fraud and the factum idea was. Originally, fraud and the factum was strictly related to the nature of the act. Here, HIV would be considered part of the nature of the act at issue. You're talking about a disease that's transmittable only through the act that occurred, which was the sexual conduct. And so what you see in Carr and Booker is they talk about, at least one of them does, about how it's the nature of the act. And also it can be in these cases where you act, the identification's at issue. You claim you're a doctor, but you really work in the motor pool. Or you claim you're somebody's husband in the dark, but you're really somebody else. So there are extensions. They're not just limited to circumstances where it's identification at issue. So Gutierrez can be viewed in two different veins. One is this, without disclosure, and there's a risk of transmission, then it's assault consummated by battery. The other one, it can be viewed under the lens of fraud and factum.
You said one thing in your brief, I believe, that seemed to indicate that if an individual, if there's not informed consent at the time, but suppose that one of the individuals in this particular case would have come forward at trial and said, hey, if I would have known about it, I would have consented, no big deal, no problem. Do you believe that's, is that a defense? If the individual that did not receive the disclosure says it wouldn't have made a difference to me at all, is it still an offense or is it not an offense?
It is an offense, Your Honor. The assault consummated by a battery would be completed upon the, I guess in this case you'd say the initial penetration. You're talking about, I think that would move into the realm of retroactive consent, really, which would not come into play. The offense itself would be completed at initial penetration, given Gutierrez's statement about how there is no consent if there is a failure to disclose HIV status.
Your position seems perhaps to be a little bit, to extend further than it needs to be, because there is another element in this case, correct? It also would have to be bodily harm or defensive touching. So wouldn't subsequent consent take away the offensive touching aspect?
Your Honor, looking at it, I guess the question here, the offensive touching in this case would be oral intercourse without disclosing HIV status. And so if you would ask that person, I don't think anyone's going to stand and say, if anybody can walk up and have oral sex with me without disclosing their HIV, under no circumstances would I consider that offensive touching. So that's the way that offensive touching should be viewed. So even if they come back later and say, I would have consented in this particular circumstance, the offensive touching is still there from an objective standpoint. The sexual act in combination with the failure to disclose would be an offensive touching if somebody just walked up on the street and started performing it on the person. That's how that can be viewed. One of the ways to look at this question of where does the interplay of I would have consented if he or she would have told me their status. I think when you look at Carr and Booker, one of the cases involving the intoxicated victim, that issue never comes up, yet they still found fraud in the factum. Carr, I believe, was the doctor, and in that case, they talk about, during the appellant's care inquiry, he talked about how they would not have consented if they had been told he worked in the motor pool. It can be evidence going towards fraud in the factum, but it's not a prerequisite.
Right, fraud in the factum, again, goes to the second element, not to the first element. Would you agree with that?
Right, and so, and that's why, although maybe I pitched it crudely, but the offensive touching in this case would be the act of intercourse in combination with the failure to disclose. And using the example, if anybody walks up in the street and does that, it's going to be an offensive touching. So you have to look at what's the actual act itself.
All right. So, what makes it offensive? Is it a person being offended, or is it the fact that the prosecutor is offended?
Well, and this goes to whether or not the offensive touching is considered subjective or objective. And what I'm saying, and the reason that I think Gutierrez gave this such short shrift in their opinion is it's straightforward, that an act of sexual intercourse with somebody, regardless of whether they're HIV or not, would be considered offensive. It's just that it's eviscerated, or that's where the consent comes into play. To use the example Senior Judge Mitchell gave earlier, punching someone in the boxing ring is offensive touching, but the consent overrides that, whereas going out and punching someone on the street is the offensive touching, but it's not overridden by consent.
Of course, that would be, there's two definitions of bodily harm, right? One is actual physical injury, and the other is an offensive touching. So I believe that explanation would probably fall under the first portion of the definition of what constitutes bodily harm, not whether or not it's an offensive touching. Would you agree or no?
You could use, for example, a good game, slap on the behind after completing a mission, maybe within the community, but then out on the street. I think that's where it comes into play. And the facts of this case are you're talking about oral and anal sexual intercourse, and so that's where the offensive touching comes in. And that's how you can partition off this idea that I would have consented if he had told me his status. From the offensive touching and consent that would be required initially, So that may be a factor when you're talking about fraud and factum, but it would not, it would basically amount to retroactive consent that would not, the crime would be completed upon penetration and the failure to disclose. The facts in this case parallel directly Gutierrez. In Gutierrez, CAF sustained the lesser included offenses for unprotected oral sex, which we have in this case, protected vaginal intercourse, which in Gutierrez, the evidence in front of the court at that point was it was only remotely possible to transmit the virus.
And in Gutierrez, another fact that was there as well was that Gutierrez actually affirmatively lied about his HIV status, didn't he? I believe two of the victims testified that he had lied about him not having STDs, and they believed him because he was in the military. So that seems to suggest that the facts in a litigated case was there's some fraud involved, some active fraud as opposed to a non-disclosure.
I believe that some of the victims may have asked him outright, but there were 8 to 10 specifications here, each naming separate victims, and I don't believe all of them specifically ever asked him the question. And so that's why the one quote they pull from Currier is non-disclosure. It specifically says non-disclosure within it. So it applies to either a affirmative lie or non-disclosure. Both amount to deceit in the eyes of Gutierrez. And as this court's already identified, since I've mentioned Cure, it's not applicable to this case or this court, the reasoning in those cases, for the reasons already cited by all three of you. The Canadian case, both cases, one deals with aggravated assault, the other aggravated sexual assault. Here we're at assault consummated by battery. CAF did not incorporate either of the cases. They did not analyze them. They did not say we're incorporating this into our jurisdiction. CAF could not have sustained the LIOs in that case if they'd had incorporated the evidentiary hurdles that appellant now requests you apply in his case. Furthermore, Mabior was the later case and defined and extrapolated out Currier. If CAF was going to cite either of the cases for incorporating it and apply it to the facts of that case, they would have used Mabior. It's clear that this court can be confident that the requirements argued by appellant, these evidentiary hurdles, are not applicable. If there's no further questions, I'd like to briefly conclude.
You may.
Appellant's care inquiry and the stipulation of fact he signed establish factual circumstances which objectively support his pleas of guilty. The additional evidentiary hurdles now argued by appellant do not apply to these charges or this court. Therefore, relying on United States v. Gutierrez, this court should find that the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he found Provident appellant's guilty plea to assault consummated by a battery and uphold appellant's conviction. Thank you.
Your Honors, if we're looking at what the offense of touching is the court briefly discussed, we don't charge STDs, we don't charge herpes as an assault and battery, we don't charge gonorrhea, we don't charge syphilis. The reason being, if it was simply an offense of touching, the fact that you had sex with somebody without acknowledging that thing, the sex itself would be the battery. That is why CAF has come out with Gutierrez and enunciated the law in Courier to establish the fact that apparently HIV is different from those. And from that extrapolation, we're looking at the likelihood of harm, which is what Courier and maybe are
having. Isn't it black letter law that just a touching in and of itself could be sufficient for assault consummated by a battery?
Yes, Your Honor.
So is there a reason that in an HIV case that we have to go through all these additional hoops to say, well, in an HIV case, all we're talking about is HIV. We can't be talking about the talk. We can't be talking about the actual contact or the touching.
Because, Your Honor, if they're not consenting to the sex, that's not assault consummated by a battery. That's a 120 charge, and that's rape. They're consenting to the sex, so the battery is not the sex. If the battery is a sex, we have rape. That's not what we have here. We have an assault consummated by a battery, which is the likelihood of harm. I mean, I think that's the key difference of how we come down on this and we look at it.
But the sex was obtained through fraud. I mean, that's really what the gist of the argument is here, is whether or not and CAF uses the term informed consent. CAF could have easily gone back to its other cases that deal with fraud and inducement, fraud in the factum, and said, this is fraud in the factum. I mean, that we could have easily done that. Maybe we're having a little different conversation here. But there's still an issue of the act and whether or not the misrepresentation is the fraudulent piece of it.
Sir, you're absolutely right. I would argue, though, it's not fraud in the factum. It's fraud in the inducement, which, as Carr and Booker enunciate, is not a crime. We may not like fraud in the inducement, but it's not a crime. And that's what we have here. Not divulging an HIV status is fraud in the inducement, which is not a crime. That's why CAF couldn't adopt fraud in the factum, which is hence why they had to reach to the Canadian law. And it goes back to your previous point in my first part, Your Honor. Why did CAF just simply cite to this without enunciating more? Your Honor, I don't have the question to that. And if they did, we probably would not be here today.
But regardless of whether they did, they did set out a principle of the law that is binding upon this court.
Absolutely, Your Honor, and it's how this court decides to apply this. You could look at it one way, that is just for that simple premise, or you could look at it as the appellate asserts, that by the premise itself is not an accurate statement of the law in Canada, and as a result, we have to look a little deeper to look at the may vitiate consent. And I think, again, it's important to look at the fact that in our military jurisprudence, there is, or through congressional intent, there's nothing to suggest that not divulging HIV status isn't in and of itself is assault consummated by a battery. CAF has created that by citing to Canadian law. And in order to completely understand that in the context, you as a court are going to be forced to look at that Canadian law to properly put that into perspective.
Counselor, I'm going to ask another few questions about Canadian law and then some questions about this issue of harm that you brought up. You would agree CAF's not bound by Canadian law. As much as respect as we may have for our neighbors to the north, they're not subordinate to Canada.
And, Your Honor, I'm out of time, if I have permission to answer your questions.
Okay.
They're not bound by Canadian law, Your Honor, but when they cite to Canadian law to establish a legal precedent, then we as a court are bound by the premises that they took from that Canadian law.
But if they're not bound by Canadian law, then if they find a dissent that lost, therefore it's the dissent more persuasive, they can cite to the dissent. If they find a case that has later been overturned, that earlier case was more persuasive, they can cite to the earlier case. So why can't they cite to a mere portion of a case and say, we find this premise that without disclosure of HIV status, there cannot be true consent. We find that to be the essential holding that we want to adopt.
Your Honor, I generally agree with what you're stating. But in this specific case, that which CAF cited, at least in Canada, is not an accurate statement of law. So if CAF just wanted that verbiage to exist and be law, then why cite to a Canadian case where that principle doesn't even stand for what they're asserting it to stand for? They could have easily just said, well, we have no congressional intent nor previous case law, but we're going to interpret it, and we, CAF, are going to decide that without divulging the status, there can be no true consent. Once you go through that mental gymnastics, we're left with the fact that if they're going to cite to that case, they must be citing to it to adopt the premise. And like I said, when we look deeper, it may vitiate consent. It is not a per se crime.
And then the other issue I wanted to address with you is you brought up again that it's the risk of harm, that's the assault or the battery, excuse me. But in Gutierrez, they talked about the unprotected oral sex, and that the expert testimony in this case is that the risk of HIV transmission was almost zero. And then they still affirmed the LIO of assault consummated by a battery. So doesn't that cut out your argument that it's the risk of harm? I mean, when they affirm in Gutierrez, when the risk of harm is almost zero?
It does, Your Honor. And I will say, out of the two, the unprotected oral sex or the protected anal sex, when we're applying the facts, especially of Mabier, we have a stronger case to get rid of the unprotected anal sex. Because much like Mabier, he has a low to moderate viral load and wore protected sex, and in our case, did not ejaculate. Could there be a situation under Gutierrez and Canadian law where somebody had oral sex and they had specific facts to their case that even more so decreased the likelihood of harm? Yes. And I will say in this case, the appellant did not ejaculate during oral sex. So this may be something that differentiates appellant's case from Gutierrez. In Gutierrez, that was not established, at least in the court's opinion. But here we have clearly on the record that the appellant did not ejaculate. So we go from a case where oral sex through sexual acts has the least likelihood or probability of transmission. We lower that even more by the fact that appellant did not ejaculate. So this might take this out of realm of Gutierrez then, and may not avoid the plea of the provency of the plea. Excuse me.
You want to briefly conclude?
I would just like to say thank you, Your Honors. I appreciate the opportunity and the questions you had today. Thank you.
Counsel, both sides, thank you for your arguments as well as your briefs. We will render a decision in due course. The court is now closed.